This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The number of people sickened by coronavirus in China is growing, and the death toll has climbed as well. Healthcare agencies in this country are keeping a close eye on the virus. So far, a handful of cases have been confirmed in the United States. So what do we know about coronavirus, and what do people need to be aware of? Well, joining me is John Lednicki. He's a microbiologist specializing in aerovirology. He's also a research professor at the University of Florida. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm also joined by Sean Beckman. He is an assistant professor of biology at Stetson University. Sean, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
John, I want to start off with you. When you sort of start to see headlines about something like coronavirus, and some of those headlines are pretty alarming, what do you think? I mean, what kind of goes through your mind? Does this just seem like a new opportunity to study some new mutation of a potentially pretty serious virus?
There are always alarming headlines. And you can imagine, being a virologist at the university, people phone me, for example, all the time with alarming stories. And I don't panic when I hear these stories. Mm-hmm. Viruses are always, there are thousands and thousands of viruses. And we've only discovered a small fraction of them. And a lot of the viruses, like this one, are zoonotic viruses.
And for the listener, for the layperson, what does that mean? Does that mean they originate in animals and there's some kind of transfer over the animal-human barrier?
Yes, that's exactly right. And there are many of these viruses that affect humans. Some have been historic. For example, measles virus, a lot of people think, originated from a similar virus that affects cattle. Hmm. And they think way back when we domesticated cattle, the virus jumped into humans and became the virus we know as measles virus. So this particular virus is very reminiscent of SARS coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And I'm not surprised. We don't know very much about this new virus yet, but I'm not surprised that it may have originated from a live animal market, and that the illness it causes is either identical or very similar to that caused by SARS.
Sean, let me bring you into this conversation. What are you thinking about as you watch the spread of this and think about, you know, what it might mean for the United States? At this point in time, there's less than 10 cases that we know of for sure, but obviously the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is keeping a pretty close eye on that. So what are you thinking about coronavirus right now?
You know, I've been keeping an eye on it and monitoring it. And, you know, I always, you know, wonder about the level of alarm that people have. And I think it's important to be aware of what's going on. But when we're looking at, you know, over 6,000 cases worldwide, but less than 100 outside of China. And like you said, for fewer than 10, I think there's 5 confirmed cases here in the United States. For me, I look at this and I think of it, unfortunately, as at the moment a largely Chinese problem, in that that's where the grand majority, overwhelming majority of issues are. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to be aware of it. It's important to keep an eye on it. But it's really important, particularly here in the United States, not panic about it. With only 5 cases reported, and with the only human-to-human transfer being reported in Asia, within China and within Vietnam, I think it's just important to follow, at this point, standard good hygiene. You know, mm-hmm. people washing their hands, people, you know, covering their mouths when they cough and sneeze, and people that are feeling ill who may have some connection, either they've been to China or they've been in contact with someone who has been there, to seek medical attention. But my bigger concern is about people panicking about this here in the U.S. rather than not being concerned enough.
Mm-hmm. And I guess there's plenty of other diseases which probably have a higher likelihood of causing problems for folks in the United States, like this current strain of influenza, right?
Right. I mean, between the current strain of influenza and, you know, the standard typical coronaviruses, the common cold that we see, those are much more likely to be causing issues. And they, luckily, it's the same type of precautions. It's following good hygiene, washing hands, keeping your hands out of your mouth and your eyes, you know, all the normal things that we learn as children that can help to prevent the spread of those and becoming infected with those. And those are certainly a much greater concern.
John Lednicki, given that your specialty is the airborne spread of viruses like coronavirus, like what we're seeing right now, what do you know about this and what are you hoping to find out as more research is done on coronavirus about the way it's spread and some of the things that could be done to prevent the spread of this?
Well, we can draw a lot from our experience with SARS coronavirus. And basically, there are two ways a lot of respiratory viruses are spread. One, the better known mode of transmission is through what's called droplet transmission. So when somebody talks, sneezes, coughs, somebody with a respiratory infection, there are these liquid droplets that come out of their expirations. And if you're close, they tend to be heavy. They settle close to the person. When you come into contact with them, if you're unfortunate enough to get something like that in your nose or possibly even the eyes, you might acquire an infection that way. But with droplets also, they settle in the environment, and you can pick them up, either, especially through your hands, and then self-inoculate yourself, either touch your eyes, your nose, and acquire an infection that way. Less understood are the truly airborne routes of transmission. So what happens is the smaller droplets that come out of your expirations can dry in the air, and virus particles, either free virus particles or virus particles with within small particles, can remain adrift for quite a while, and they can spread away from the person. Now, they get diluted as they're leaving. The farther away from the person, the more they spread in the air. And that decreases your chance of breathing them in.
Sean Beckman, obviously doctors are racing to find some kind of antiviral for this particular outbreak as fast as possible. What does that process look like? And typically, how long does it take for doctors and researchers to get a handle on something like this?
One of the first steps in the process has already been accomplished, which is they've sequenced the genome of this virus, and if I remember correctly, that genome has now been made publicly available so that it can kind of be tackled from lots of different avenues. There are several antivirals that are used against things like influenza and are used against, attempted to be used against coronaviruses. The process is now figuring out which one of those may be effective against this particular type of virus, coronavirus, or potentially worst case, having to develop new ones that might be able to be effective against that. Screening through that genome to identify, you know, where it differs from other viruses is going to be key in that, and identifying potential targets that that current antivirals might be able to use against, and then culturing that virus in the laboratory and seeing what types of medications might be effective against it are, you know, the forefront of that. And then, of course, you know, the end goal is, in many cases, people are hoping for a vaccine to be developed against this, although oftentimes by the time you get to the stage of vaccine development, effective vaccine development, these epidemics like this often peter themselves out before that becomes a necessity.
We've read some stories about the fact that the Chinese authorities are taking some pretty strong steps to try and prevent the spread of this. They're installing like temperature scanners in airports and things, but also you have folks like a woman who was bragging that she passed the coronavirus screening at the airport by taking a medicine to lower her fever. So how much of what we're seeing is effective, and how much of it do you think might just be to kind of reassure people?
That's a really great question. I think there's important steps being taken in China in that this is the epicenter of this, and there is a lot of virus that we're seeing now, over 6,000 cases, and the numbers are growing day by day. They need to be taking steps to attempt to limit exposure and limit transmission of this. You know, we saw last week the closing of, you know, Shanghai Disneyland as an attempt to limit people interacting who may be exposed to this. I think installing things like temperature scanners and whatnot are potentially effective. They certainly have the possibility of mitigating some of the spread, but a lot of it is going to fall on the people themselves, on people who are sick, seeking medical treatment and staying away from other people, and on people that are in areas where this virus is prevalent, to taking the necessary steps that Jonathan and I have been talking about in order to prevent becoming sick themselves.
John, if you think about what might be the response from officials, if this were to come to Florida in some form or other, do you get the sense that people would get the information and would sort of take some of these precautions that you've been talking about, or is it sort of yet untested?
Well, I can speak for the University of Florida. They've put out some very good information and informed both the students and the communities about this virus, and alerted them that our health, the University of Florida associated, affiliated healthcare centers are ready for this. And so I think the information has reached out. What we have to worry about is are two things. One are the people who panic, and there are a lot of people who are panicky right now in Florida because a lot of people have respiratory infections right now. But it's respiratory virus season. There's a lot of influenza. We also have a real problem with pollen right now. Pine pollen's making a lot of people suffer from allergies. And so people who don't have enough information panic about that. The second thing we have to be worried about are all the people who are now on the web pushing for cures and therapies against this virus. And there are people who are claiming, for example, that if you take triple antibiotic cream and rim your nostrils with it, it'll protect you against this virus. And there are really other things that are on the more humorous side. So something that keeps going around, for example, is if you could take a potato and cut it in half and put it beside you, that there's some sort of magic magnetic thing that happens where viruses are drawn to the potato. Unfortunately, people who are not very well informed don't take the time to really research the facts, and they listen to this.
Sean Beckman, just some final thoughts for you. What's your advice to people who want to know a little bit more about this and maybe want some reassurance about what's happening in China and thinking about what could be coming, you know, if there are more cases that pop up in the United States?
I think for people that want to educate themselves, and I will completely echo Jonathan on this, is don't believe everything that you see on the internet. There are good sources and there are not so good sources. And certainly the CDC is doing a really good job of keeping information up to date that is out there. So going to the CDC website, I believe it's cdc.gov is a great place to get information. They've got lots of really good information on there, including symptoms, transmission, and up-to-date information on where the virus is. And just staying on top of where it is and what's going on, educating yourself using good resources, and like Jonathan said, not panicking. There's lots of respiratory issues going on right now between allergies and other viruses, and they're not this novel coronavirus at the moment in the United States, and hopefully will not be. So use good hygiene practices, do what you do to prevent getting a cold and a flu, and inform yourself with good resources.
Well, Sean Beckman is an assistant professor of biology at Stetson University. Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by John Lednicki. He's a microbiologist specializing in aerobiology and a UF research professor. John, thank you as well.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, a closer look at the scandal that led to the firing of three University of Central Florida faculty members and what that means for the university. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This week, the University of Central Florida announced it will fire 3 faculty members at the Institute for Simulation and Training, and that includes Director Randall Shoemaker. That's after UCF said an investigation revealed they helped a student get a PhD in exchange for grant funding. The university has named retired US Navy Captain Wes Naylor as interim director of the institute while it searches for a permanent director. Well, for more on what the scandal at the Institute for Simulation and Training means for UCF, we're joined by Annie Martin. She covers education for the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So this, on the face of it, just looks like one more bad batch of news for the University of Central Florida. Just get us caught up to speed and remind us what exactly happened at the Institute for Simulation and Training. It does seem like it's a bad look for the university.
That's right. So on Monday afternoon, the university released an investigation that was done by an outside law firm that showed that a student was able to fraudulently obtain a PhD degree. And the way the student did this was by withholding grant money from an outside agency in exchange for getting his dissertation approved and making progress towards his degree, or at least that's what the report claims. And as a result of this investigation, the university has moved to fire 3 faculty members, including the director of its Institute for Simulation and Training, and started the process of revoking the student's PhD degree.
How bad is this on the scale of bad things that can happen to an academic institution like a university or a college? Like, what does this mean for the reputation of the University of Central Florida?
Well, you know, I don't know that I would put a number rating on this, but, you know, obviously the university's reputation is tied very closely to the validity of the degrees that it produces and the research it produces. And so I would think for an academic institution, if something were to come out saying that they were, you know, even giving one degree that someone really didn't have the right to earn, that's not a great look for the institution.
And just remind us, how important is the Institute for Simulation and Training for the university? It seems to me from what I've read that they're very proud of this institution. It's kind of a feather in the cap for UCF. So is this a blow for that institution?
I would think so. And, you know, it's a part of the university that produces quite a bit of research from what I understand. And, you know, sort of another interesting aspect of it is that the university did an internal investigation and thought that that had dealt with the problem. But after another complaint, you know, hired a law firm to investigate. So I think a big question for the university going forward will be, you know, have they instituted the correct or, you know, adequate protocol to make sure that this doesn't happen again? Or, you know, what types of steps are they taking to make sure that another student isn't able to get a degree fraudulently.
Now, the student who is, you know, identified in the report as being part of this scheme, his dissertation included quote-unquote unattributed work and editorial assistance from other students. Do we know what might happen to those other students, if anything?
We don't. That's not apparently addressed in the report, but I do think that that is a question that the university will have to answer going forward because, you know, obviously helping another student do their work or even completing another student's work on their behalf is not something that's looked kindly upon in academic institutions.
So we learned from the report that institute employees were pressured to get outside grant funding, and those who secured $1 million were part of the quote-unquote millionaires club. So I'm just wondering what this says to you, Annie, about the quest for grant funding, for incentive money, and whether there needs to be a closer look at the way institutions, whether it's UCF or others, go about securing that funding.
Yeah, certainly it sounds like researchers in this particular program were under a lot of pressure to secure outside funding. And obviously in this case, they were going about securing that funding in a way that's, you know, compromised the academic integrity of what they were doing. But I do think that's a question that UCF is going to have to deal with. Are academics and faculty members under undue pressure to secure money for their research? And how can they ensure that in the future they're not, you know, sacrificing the academic integrity of their programs in pursuing that funding?
And I guess it's important to note, too, that because the fact that there were complaints, and not just one, as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, there were people in the institution who were very uncomfortable with what was going on.
Yes, clearly. And, you know, I think the fact that, the university thought they had dealt with the issue after an internal investigation, but then realized that there was still an issue, raises some questions about, you know, how the university is dealing with these kinds of complaints and whether they're giving them the thorough vetting that they deserve.
Now, one of the people who is being ousted as part of the investigation is the head of the institution, Randall Shoemaker. He recently received an award from the National Training and Simulation Association for lifelong contributions to modeling and simulations. I'm wondering, Annie, if what's happened now might cast some doubt on that award, or even just, looking at his career overall, if there might be some questions over that now, too.
Yeah, that's possible. And, you know, this is a story that we're continuing to report on and dig into. We've requested some more documents from the university. So, you know, I think that there's a good chance questions about, sort of the integrity of people's careers and their past achievements will come up during that process.
As I mentioned at the top of our conversation, Annie, it hasn't been a great year for the University of Central Florida. If you kind of put it all in totality, what does this now mean for the university? Do they have some more kind of groundwork to do in terms of restoring the reputation of UCF?
Well, sure. And of course, this is a very important time for the university because they're embarking on the search for a new president, and they're hoping to, name a new leader by the springtime and have that person in place by early summer. So certainly if you're a high-level academic who's applying for, top posts at a university, you'd be looking at this and realize that, you know, this is the kind of, question or situation you're going to have to deal with if you accept a position at UCF. Now, I think it's important to note the provost, Elizabeth Dooley, was placed on paid leave a couple weeks ago. That's a very academic-focused role. However, the university said that, her being placed on leave was not related to this investigation, although they haven't been clear about why she was placed on paid leave. So I think it's important to make that distinction since that's another, personnel issue that's come up in the last few weeks.
In the course of your reporting on UCF over the last, 12 to 24 months, do you kind of have some questions like, why is it that so many top-level folks seem to be getting into strife and remove? What is going on at UCF?
Yeah, I think that those are, questions we're going to be asking about. And, maybe these issues are related and maybe they're not. But it does seem like, at least in this case, somebody raised some questions along the way and the university thought that they had dealt with them. And it turns out they hadn't. So that kind of raises some questions about, sort of the university's ability or the process they were using to deal with those kinds of complaints.
Well, Annie Marson is an education reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. We've been talking about the removal of three faculty members at the Institute for Simulation and Training. Annie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, what defines Orlando for you? Is it the Swans and Lake Eola, Disney World, the I-4 eyesore, the Orlando Magic? We'll talk to a panel of writers about how they see Central Florida and their role in reflecting and sometimes creating the identity of the city of Orlando. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Nathan Hollick's new novel, Bright Lights, Medium-Sized City, is set in Orlando, and it's as much about a city trying to find its identity as it is a main character searching for his place in the world. Landmarks like the spires of Cinderella's castle, the I-4 eyesore, the Eatonville Archway, or Lake Eola form the backdrop for not just Hollick's work, but a host of Central Florida writers, from authors of young adult fiction to screenwriters. We invited a group of writers, including Hollick, to stop by the studio to talk about writing about Orlando. Jenny Torres-Sanchez is the author of books including Because of the Sun, Death Dickinson, and The Demented Life of Frenchie Garcia, and The Downside of Being Charlie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Lauren Gibaldi, whose books include The Night We Said Yes, Autofocus, and This Tiny Perfect World. Lauren, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
And Nathan Hollick, his most recent novel is Bright Lights, Medium-Sized City. Nathan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Jason Gregory, author and screenwriter, currently shopping his pilot for a TV series, Waking Up White, which was filmed in Eatonville.
Yes, yes.
Thank you as well.
Thank you.
So, Nathan, I want to start with you. Your novel was set in the late 2000s, and it kind of feels as much like a book about a city trying to find its place in the world as your main character, who is going through something of a midlife crisis, even though he's not really at that stage yet.
That's a good characterization of it, definitely.
So why pick Orlando as a setting? What was it about the city? Obviously, the fact that you live here makes it kind of a good scene setter, but what was it that made you think, here's a time and a place I can write about that makes sense for a book like this?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that I started with the idea of the city. So I didn't necessarily know when it was going to take place, but I'm a big fan of city fiction. I'm a big fan of TV shows like The Wire and Tremé that take a city and kind of make a character out of it. Some of my favorite books are The Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe. I mean, that's on the copy in the back of the book. So clearly that's an influence. But I really enjoy how an author can create a character out of a place. And I'd always wondered why Orlando didn't have that. Like, the only time Orlando ever wound up on screen, and Jason, you could probably speak to this, is when we saw like a sitcom where the characters would all go to the Magic Kingdom. And so that was always the characterization of Orlando, and the only time it showed up was the theme parks, or even when Ellen would film an episode or something in Orlando. And so why hadn't anyone ever explored Orlando in cinema or in literature? And so I kind of started with that premise. What would a book about Orlando look like? What is Orlando's true character? And then only when I really started writing it, and it was sort of displaced, I think, when I first started writing it, did I decide that I needed to settle on a time, because the character of a city is different from decade to decade. The 90s Orlando is different than 80s Orlando is different than clearly 2009 or 2019. I mean, the city now, if your listeners are here and they were here for two decades, like it's dramatically different than 2009.
Isn't that kind of weird? I mean, the late 2000s isn't that long ago, but it feels like we're kind of peering back into the distant past.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and even I got here in 99. And in 99, it seemed like this was a city on the grow. But I even think about different intersections at that time that were barren or run down, and what they look like now, and like how different neighborhoods that hadn't been built yet. Like, it felt like everything was happening in 99. And then again, in 2009, it felt like everything was collapsing. And I'm not really sure right now. I think I'll need a decade to figure out what 2019 is all about.
Right. Jason, I saw you nodding your head there, sort of thinking about Orlando depicted on film, either big screen or on TV. And your screenplay looks at a very specific slice. I mean, Eatonville is a separate city, right? So it's a very kind of specific part of Orlando or adjacent to Orlando. Why pick that as the setting for your TV series?
Well, Eatonville is just full of rich culture. So much has happened there. We kind of borrowed from the history of Eatonville and Paramore. And we created our own fictitious town called Wellsville. So, back in, 1920s, Dr. William Monroe Wells created, a hotel for African-Americans that were coming through Orlando who weren't allowed to, stay at white-only hotels. So we kind of took from what Dr. Wells was doing, and we took from the history of Eatonville, kind of put them together, the Wells and the Ville, and created Wellsville. So we wanted to make, just as Nathan was saying, we wanted to take that town and make it a character in the program as well, and track it from during, back when Wellsville was created, or even when Eatonville was created, track it through the Great Black Migration, from the 1920s to the 1970s. Look at how integration played a part, look how segregation played a part, and then, bring it up to date.
And then if you look at Edenville or even Paramore, I guess now, I mean, to Nathan's point about Orlando being a city on the grow, these two communities are kind of being squeezed by other forces, right? Like gentrification, you've got roads kind of cutting through them.
Yep.
So in some ways, they're a little precarious, it seems.
Yeah, you look at Paramore and, you know, it's downtown Orlando was on the grow. But because downtown Orlando was on the grow, Paramore is, you know, people that have lived in Paramore their entire lives, you know, some of them are being displaced and they have nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And then you look at somewhere like Eatonville, which is stuck right in the middle of Maitland and Winter Park. And those two cities are growing, you know, like crazy. And people are starting to look at Eatonville like, hey, I want that waterfront property that you're sitting on that five generations may have sat, you know, been sitting on in Eatonville. You know, mm-hmm. what can we do to get it?
Jenny, I want to bring you into this conversation. I've got a book, one of your books in front of me. It's We Are Not From Here. But I want to talk also about another book you wrote called Because of the Sun. And this is about a girl who has a difficult relationship with her mother. And she leaves Florida to live in New Mexico after her mother dies. But let's just talk a little bit about the setting, you know, of the start of that book, at least, in kind of suburban Florida. What does that setting mean to you? And I'm just kind of wondering, is it challenging sort of writing about the suburbs in Florida versus the city? Talk about that process.
Yeah, not really, because I moved here when I was about 10 years old. And so I have this very split, kind of split childhood where I had a very New York childhood when from, you know, birth till 10. And then my teen years were here in you know, suburbia and the cul-de-sacs and all of that stuff. So
right.
I just really wrote about that and what I didn't like Florida when I moved here. I hated it. It was so different from where I lived. There was none of the places that I was familiar with, the pizzerias, the delis, the bakeries, none of that existed. And you couldn't walk anywhere. So I think I just kind of brought that angst and the way that I felt about Florida into my characters who are teenagers and who are very angsty and, you know, kind of wanting to break out of this place.
Mm-hmm. If you think about the city as a character, does Orlando feel a bit like a teenager at times, kind of trying to figure itself out?
It absolutely does. Just kind of like not knowing what it is, being a lot of different things. And being misunderstood by a lot of other people, which I think is exactly what, you know, the teenage perspective is.
And having been here for some time now, do you feel a sense of defensiveness? Because sometimes Orlando or Florida broadly can be the butt of jokes. I mean, if you think about culture and food and writing, oftentimes people are looking at Florida and saying, what's going on there? That's not like New York or LA or where have you. But do you kind of feel now that you need to spread the word about these unique places that do exist in Florida and should be celebrated and explored?
I do. And actually, a couple of years ago, I wrote an essay for Borough Press that was titled If You Moved to Florida in 1989. Mm-hmm. And I likened Florida to my little sister that, like, is really annoying and, you know, I kind of can't stand. And I'm okay. It's okay for me to make fun of. But if anybody else does, you know, we're going to have some words.
Yeah.
And that's very much how I feel about Florida. You know, like, it's okay for me and Lauren and Nathan and Jason to, like, kind of make fun of it and all of its, you know, oddities, but anybody else, I feel like I do kind of have to correct them and say, well, you know, I don't really think you know what it is.
Lauren, the character in one of your books, This Tiny Perfect World, I guess she has a slightly different perspective, right? She loves the place she lives, so at the start at least, and it takes some kind of growing to see that there's a world out beyond her small perfect town.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it takes place in Christmas, Florida, and Christmas is a place where if you say there's a Christmas Florida, everyone thinks it's Santa and you know, snow all the time, and it's not. It's a complicated city that has really beautiful parts, and then it also has Confederate flags. So I likened that to her, where she thought that everything was perfect in her life. She had a really great life, but there's more out there, and not just a stereotype of a girl. So yeah, it starts in Christmas, and it uses landmarks around there. They go to the largest fake gator, which is a place in Christmas, Florida, and to the Alafaya Branch Library where I work. So that was a fun throw in, and then all around downtown and Winter Park. So mm-hmm. it was kind of fun incorporating all of those things and showing not just the stereotype of Florida. And another, just to bring back to the movie conversation, kind of like a stereotype of Christmas being always perfect, there's a stereotype of Florida always being perfect as well. And then there's movies like The Florida Project that came out that kind of showed a more gritty side of it as well. Mm-hmm. So I showed a little more of a gritty side of it.
Are we at that point, do you think, where we're okay sort of seeing these movies or reading these books which show the gritty side of Florida and we're not going to get defensive about it?
I'll still be defensive. Like Jenny said, like, you can make fun of, like, SNL literally made fun of Orlando this weekend. And I will be defensive. I will defend it. I will defend Orlando, but also make fun of it at the same time because I can, because yeah. it's my city.
When you started writing fiction, did you sort of think, I'm definitely going to be right, like, my characters are going to live in Florida, they're going to be all Florida, or did you think I need to look elsewhere?
I've always written about Florida because I went to high school here. Like Jenny, I moved here in 96 when I was going into eighth grade. So for my first book, I was kind of like, channel that teenage mindset. And my teenage mindset was Altamont Springs, Florida. So I set a lot around there, and I like the idea of using real locations because it kind of makes the book more real to me. And something we mentioned earlier was that setting a location that you know about makes a book feel specific in mm-hmm. a way, and not just this overview of like Magic Kingdom. So right. I liked writing about that. So my first book takes place in Orlando, second is Tallahassee, where I went to college, and third is back in Orlando.
Nathan, kind of thinking about setting and some of your comments earlier about, you know, the city now feeling a lot different from even when it did in like 98 or 99 or 2000. I mean, there's some nice visual elements too, because you have a background in graphic art as well and editing right. comics and the like. And one of the things that strikes me is some of the landmarks you're talking about are writing yeah. about, like the Merit of Bread sign. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore. Right. So people of a certain era will remember driving down yeah. I-4, rolling down the window and smelling the delicious smell of baking yeah. bread.
Yeah. Yes.
And
yes.
some say that it's still there.
Right, right, hearts. Right. Well, I mean, I think the sign still exists somewhere, right? Somebody saved it?
I think so. That and the concrete work of the round building where mm-hmm. the Dr. Phillips Center is now. I think right. they're saved somewhere, but, you know, a sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark type of warehouse.
Sure.
No one will ever see them.
And one of the characters in your book is kind of like he's totally into, preserving Orlando. Yes. He's like every single little hip niche bar, he's got to make sure that people know about it.
Right.
I mean, this seems like a character who is somebody very lovingly created.
Well, so I think that, you know, kind of building off of what Lauren and Jenny had said about the types of characters that are in their book, I think that, you know, there's not just one type of Florida person and not one type of Orlando person. And I think the more that they've written, they've explored several different types of people who come to Florida or leave Florida. And so, you know, the challenge of my 600-page book would be to populate it with as many different types of characters as possible. And yeah, I have a blogger in the book who's like madly in love with Orlando and incredibly defensive of Orlando and wants to write, you know, the ultimate listicle about Orlando, all of the places to go. And so that was my opportunity to almost be a kind of blog and, mm-hmm. and show the places that mean something to the area. And then a couple of fake places, too. It was also my opportunity to forever immortalize Beefy King in literature, right. yes. which I think is important. You know, I think that's an important thing to do.
Right. I mean, it came perilously close to perishing in a fire right. recently, yeah. too, right? So
I had an old creative writing professor, and she was really into Southern literature. She went on to work for the Southern Review at LSU, and she was really upset, you know, around the time of Katrina. Of course, she had Southern ties, mm-hmm. But she talked about the literature of New Orleans being important in a situation like that to preserve a place even when certain things get washed away. And I know it's not as serious, but when there was the fire at Beefy King, that was one thing that I thought about. Like, when we lose something in real life, that's why literature and cinema, that's why that's so important.
Jason, your screenplay is kind of, the premise is pretty startling, right? I wonder if you just got to lay it out for our listeners, what exactly is going on with this family that you're depicting?
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to ask Nathan real quick, though, with all the landmarks you have, do you ever think you'll put the building from I-4 in one of your stories?
It's on the cover.
It's on the cover. Wow, look at that.
It doesn't get more Orlando than that, right?
Will you put that into your pilot?
Oh, absolutely. Awesome. Yeah, that is great. Yeah, that and Florida Man, you know. So the premise for Waking Up White, it's about a black family that wakes up white, and they have 30 days to decide if they want to go back to their cultural roots or stick with the skin that they're in. Going a little bit further, you know, once they wake up, the neighborhood that they fled, which was Wellsville, is in the early stages of gentrification. So now whatever decision they make not only affects them, but it also affects the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Are you kind of using, and I've sort of read through the synopsis and the like, but are you sort of using the like humor as a way to get the audience into some pretty challenging and difficult themes and concepts?
Absolutely, because we talk about racism, we talk about classism, we talk about colorism, we talk about a lot of isms. And when I first started out with this, it was actually a feature film, and it was very dark. It was about 75-80 pages, and it was a dark, you know, drama. And I said, you know what? Maybe I should just really flip this into a TV series, because, you know, then we could talk about all of the issues on a weekly basis. So that's what I did. And since we had already done all the research, it was easier to kind of pepper in the comedy, you know, mm-hmm. at the right times, because we found that comedy, it's easier to digest the message with some comedy.
Right. And sort of thinking, you know, picking up of what Nathan's doing in his fiction, do you sort of feel like you have a chance to preserve something that exists and also kind of make a new reality in your writing?
Yeah, and that's the goal, to create a new reality here, and, you know, just show the audience, you know, really what's happening maybe with Black Orlando instead of just Orlando as a whole.
And you could tell the story anywhere mm-hmm. in the United States, right?
Yeah, or but even outside the country, yeah.
But are there some things that kind of make it unique to whether you're sort of this amalgam of Eatonville and Paramore or Orlando, Central Florida in general?
Yeah, just, you know, again, all the landmarks, you know, that we will see, Eatonville, because in the pilot, we show the town hall of Eatonville. We just kind of covered it up. We show just the Ville in the Eatonville sign. So, you know, people will recognize those landmarks. And we also shot, you know, around Maitland and Winter Park also, because, you know, they're right on the other side of them. So,
yeah,
we kind of journeyed outside of Eatonville a bit.
Mm-hmm. Jenny, when you think about your audience, who do you kind of envisage reading your books? Like, are you sort of writing for folks who live in Florida and kind of get those visual cues or your descriptions of certain parts of suburbia, or are you just writing for anyone of a certain age?
Well, I write for young adults, so primarily my readers are teenagers. Really, the teenage perspective is so unique. It's so interesting, right? And just this feeling of being trapped somewhere and really wanting to go out and explore and see what else is out there. Mm-hmm. So when I'm writing, I'm really trying to kind of make sure that I stay true to that perspective. You know, and then if you are a teenager here in Orlando in Florida, I think it's really cool to see those landmarks and those places that you've been, or those kind of B-sides, if you will, of Orlando, and being like, hey, I know what this is, and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of feeling included at a time when you feel very kind of like not included in anything as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about your audiences, Lauren?
I mean, pretty much what Jenny said. I write for teenagers as well. It's the same where if you are from this area, you kind of get a lot of the visual stuff, and that's fun. And if you don't, then you just kind of get a new piece of Florida, and that's mm-hmm. fun too. They could assume that I made it up, which I didn't. I changed some places' names, but mm-hmm. For the most part, it's all real places, so it's a lot of fun. Actually, two of mine, one of my books and one of Jenny's books, both deal with downtown Orlando, and I think with both of our books, you can visit like most of the hot spots. Like mm-hmm. Jenny yeah. has the Swans, and she has various places on Orange. And then, and that's in her Death Dickinson and Demented Life of Frenchie Garcia. And then in This Tiny Perfect World, they're downtown and they go to all of the statues around Lake Eola, like the woman half underground. And mm-hmm. they do the music on the library wall where you could put your hand and it plays music. They go to the pizza place on downtown Orange, so you can kind of do a nice little tour of downtown Orlando with our books.
Thinking about sort of fiction and the setting and Florida, Central Florida is often a place where people come to sort of experience something magical or fantastical. Mm-hmm. Jason, do you feel like that gives you a bit of freedom to sort of create a new Florida that people maybe haven't experienced before?
Yeah, absolutely. Because when all of my family talks about coming down here, they think that I live right next to Disney World. So yeah, it gives me the freedom to go ahead and create something else because, you know, truth be told, and I think we all, you know, realize this, Orlando doesn't have a true identity except for...
Still?
Yeah, except for Disney World. Like, that's, you know, Disney World and Universal, you know. So, yeah, I enjoy being able to create something else.
Mm-hmm. We have a flag, though.
Yeah, we do have a flag. But is there anything that we can, like, really, you know, hang our hat on and say, yes, this is what we do? I mean, maybe back in the 90s, you know, we had, what, Lou Pearlman, and he was creating all
the
boy bands, you know. But, you know, that age is dead and gone at this point. So what are we known for now?
Is that something that you see as a kind of perpetual challenge as a writer? Is it an opportunity?
It's both. It's a problem and it's a good opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we can create, you know, something that we can become known for. You look at Atlanta. Atlanta's known for film and TV. Philly is known for brotherly love and great, you know, cheesesteaks and pretzels. And, you know, what can Orlando be known for?
The Swans?
The Swans, yeah. Swans and Gators, you know.
I-4
building, yeah.
And the I-4 and I-4.
Yeah, the I-4
and love
I-4,
it.
Yeah.
Nathan, do you feel like you kind of captured the city, or did you get to the end of the book and you're like, this is like an ongoing challenge. I'm going to have to come back and write a companion in like 10 years or something.
Yeah, well, I think I captured a moment, and I think that's the best a book can do. I think that one thing that I would love is for the book to be sort of like an early chapter itself, a very long early chapter.
You're gonna say how many pages is it?
No, okay. You know, in a conversation that keeps going, and that's why I think, you know, y'all's work is also important in that conversation, is that the identity of the city might be slightly different in each one of those books, and it's only sort of taken together that we have a, you know, a real, a more complete picture. And the more writers, specifically local writers, that take up that challenge, you know, I think that the clearer the picture becomes.
Well, let me ask you all then what you're working on now, and starting with you, Jason, what's next for you?
Just doing a lot of producing and teaching. I'm teaching at UCF right now, teaching screenwriting to about 80 students, so that's fun, reading screenplays every day. Also, I'm working on a feature film with a good buddy of mine named Tim Ritter, who also works at UCF, and it's called Echoes, and it's kind of a post-apocalyptic type film, just kind of starting the earth all over again, seeing what would happen.
Seems very off the moment.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And what about Waking Up White? Where might we see that at some point down the track?
Yeah, it's making its rounds around on the film festival circuit. We're also talking to a couple of different networks about, you know, possible TV series. Networks as well as streaming platforms about a possible TV series. And also looking to possibly, you know, turn it into a web series.
Right. Nathan Hollick, what does an author who's just, you know, published a 600-page novel do next?
Yeah, I got a 1,200-page book. No, I want to write something short.
Right.
I was really I read Stepford Wives this past summer. I was really affected by that and by the brevity of the prose and the efficiency of it. It's less than 200 pages, and it's, you know, probably the best sort of horror novel I've ever read. So I want to write a Stepford Wives. That's my goal now.
So horror of some sort.
Yeah, but it's sort of suburban horror, right? Like, but my thought is instead of the wives, the children. Yeah. I'll leave it cryptic.
The Stepford Kids.
Yeah.
Lauren, what are you working on?
I have an anthology coming out in 2021 called Battle of the Bands with Candlewick. I'm co-editing it with my friend Eric Smith. And it's about a Battle of the Bands that takes place in one night. And we have 14 authors, including us, who wrote a different story for each, and they interweave. So it's each band that performs as well as side figures. Jenny has a story in it as well. And we're really excited about it.
Did you go to a lot of those?
I did. I played drums in high school. Oh. I competed in one full Battle of the Bands, and we were terrible, but it was a lot of fun.
And Jenny, what are you working on?
I am gearing up for my book that comes out in May. It's called We Are Not From Here, and it's about three migrant teens from Guatemala who are trying to get to Mexico so that they can then get on La Bestia, which is the train that a series of trains that go through Mexico to the U.S. border. Hmm. And so they're fleeing danger in their home country and trying to seek refuge here.
Well, Ginny Torres-Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Lauren Gibaldi. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Nathan Hollick, thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.
And Jason Gregory, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Nathan Hollick will be talking about his book And Orlando with historian James C. Clark at Writer's Block in Winter Park this Friday evening. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week marks 1 year since the death of TSA officer Robert Henry. And next week on Intersection, we'll take a look back at the 12 months since his suicide at Orlando International Airport and allegations of bullying and retaliation at TSA. Tune in to hear a discussion with journalists, experts, former TSA officers, friends and colleagues of Henry's. In an event recorded live at the Orlando Public Library, we'll ask what's changed at TSA and what comes next. That's on Intersection, Thursday at 12 noon and 9 p.m. on WMFE and WMFV. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.